disrespect.
Much.
But, I mean, the whole day they are showing that they are sad by wearing, for example, from in different cultures, wearing black, I mean, beating on their chest in a normal way. So, I mean, through different
expressions of sorrow and sadness.
They express their sadness. And the next point is that Islam is a religion of moderation and balance. So sometimes we see that some people, just to give you an example, wear black the whole year. And even when it comes to the these days of Eid and feast and I mean happiness of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi wasalam, they also have mourning ceremonies for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Or for example, I've seen among I mean some people, of course there are very few in number, that for example on the day of the birth of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam, they hold some ceremonies for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam to be happy, but then they begin to recite all those afflictions which happened for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam too.
Yes.
So I think it's kind of going to extreme too. As I mentioned, the seerah of the Ahlul Bayt is that we need to be happy when they are happy and to be sad when they are sad. So to make the whole year a kind of, opportunity to weep for Imam Hussein alayhi salam is going to extreme. And the narrations are, even if a person tell us that all the time I remember Imam Hussein alayhi salam, okay, you can't be sad in your heart. Al-mu'minu bishruhu fi wajhihi wa huznuhu fi qalbihi. This is one of the features of the believers, that they keep their sadness in their heart, but when it comes to their face, their countenance, they are happy, they are laughing. So I'm not talking about the sad occasions, I'm not talking about the Day of Ashura, Tasu'a, and the martyrdom of other imams.
On normal circumstances.
Yeah,
normal
circumstances. People, and I mean, Islam expects the people to weigh in a normal way, to be happy and to, see the people. I mean, people see you while you have a smile on your face. For example, this is the seerah of the Prophet. It's been mentioned that he was, I think, the narration reads Aktharu Tabastoman. He was the person who was smiling the most. Of course, he preserved some etiquette of laughing too, but he was always seen smiling with a happy face. So this is the role models that we need to follow. The third point, which is a very important point, and sometimes some people misunderstand sadness for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam and the other family members of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, is that some people think that sadness means being bad-tempered. And this is a kind of misunderstanding. I mean, for example, on Day of Ashura, they want to say that I'm very sad. At the same time, they pretend and, I mean, they show that they are angry too. I mean, as soon as their wife or, I mean, kids, they want to, I mean, talk to them, they act in a, I mean, angry way. So these two should not be confused. I've seen some people, to show that they are sad, they are also in one way or I'm not talking about the majority of the people, because
right.
It seems that it's weird to you.
It's very weird.
Yeah.
I was going to ask about this.
Yeah.
They do not fit together, being sad and angry. Maybe if you have resentment and you're bitter, you will be angry, but not at your family or friends. You will be angry at the enemies, perhaps.
Let me give you maybe a real example. So on the Day of Ashura, for example, I try to be sad. I'm really sad. And then my kid comes to me, I mean, let's say a 2 years baby, I mean, child of me, a daughter, a boy, for example, comes to me and asking me to play with him or her.
Right.
And I know that this is Day of Ashura. I want to show that I'm sad, so I talk to him in a very angry way, that this is Day of Ashura, we are not, I mean, allowed
to teach him a lesson.
Yeah. So, but the point is that sadness is different from anger. We can instruct him or her that we are sad, but not in an angry method. So this is another point that I would like to share, the fact that to be sad doesn't mean that we can be bad temper. No.
Right.
And the last point, which is related to this question, is that at the end of the day, we are the followers of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his family members. And even if we laugh during the month of Muharram, and even if we laugh on the day of Ashura, we are not included in this part of the Ziyar of Ashura, which reads, Hada Yamul Farah Had Bihi Al Ziyad Wa Al Marwan. This is the day that the progeny of Ziyad and Marwan, they were rejoicing by the Qatlihim al Hussein. They were happy because they killed Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
That's the reasoning.
That's the reason. So they were happy for murdering Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So us, the Shia, even if we see that some people, they are they are laughing on the day of Ashura, we cannot call them that they are like Ahl al-Ghiyad, Ahl al-Marwan, na'udhu billah.
That's a very big accusation.
Yeah, it's a big accusation. Very dangerous to say so. Again, I repeat that we are highly recommended to be sad, but even if we see some people, I mean, laughing, we cannot, I mean, they should not think, and we cannot accuse them to be like Al-Ziyad, Al-Marwan, because the philosophy of their rejoicing was Qatl al-Hussein, and no Shia can be happy for murdering Imam Hussein al-Islam.
Exactly.
Even if those people who are laughing, when you ask them, definitely the answer is that they are sad, deep in their heart, and they are not happy for na'udhu billah killing Imam al-Hasir.
Of course not. That is, as we say, ba'id anum. It's too far away from.
Yeah. So
that's not something to do.
The intention matters a lot here. The intention is absolutely different from that of al-Ziyad and al-Marwan.
So in summarization, laugh, but not to your... No, I wouldn't say laugh. Try not to laugh.
Yeah.
But if you laughed, no, you would not be counted among the enemies of the Hujjatullah, the Imam of the Islamic community. Of course not, you wouldn't.
Sure.
That's illogical. And on that note, we will end today's program. I thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in, and I thank you, dear Sheikh, for sharing his knowledge with us. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio.
إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن علي حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا
Around the World with Reporters.
As an example of popular resistance, Palestinians held several rallies on Thursday along the separation fence. There were huge night confrontations, and Palestinians called for a complete lifting of the siege imposed on the Gaza Strip as a result of the continuous gathering by the borders that has been going on for almost 2 weeks. The Israeli regime began to submit to the Palestinian pressure as a list of Palestinian demands has been implemented.
Israel's new measures and facilities are not coming for the favor of the Palestinian side as much as they come to prevent the Palestinian outrage and try to restore peace by the border. Israel is afraid of these gatherings that represent the popular resistance resulted from the deteriorating life Gazans are living. These facilitations are never enough, and Palestinians want a complete end of the siege.
During the clashes, Palestinians burned tires and threw explosives to disturb the Israeli army. The regime soldiers fired live bullets and tear gas at protesters during the nighttime clashes.
Those are not facilitations. The new decisions are simple rights of the Palestinians that the Israeli regime has deprived us of for 50 years. Palestinians are living their worst times ever. While there is no medicine, no food, and we have to take action, all spheres of Gazans are here protesting peacefully, and these protests are ongoing until all the blockade is over.
Palestinians insist on keeping the resistance, starting from nightly confusion to incendiary balloons and clashing with the Israeli regime along the borders. The Israeli regime has not yet kept up with the demands of Palestinians, including ending the crippling blockade. Meanwhile, the resistance confirms that the Israeli new measures are not enough.
These Israeli facilities are not a gift from Israel. There are legal Palestinian rights, and this move shows that the Palestinian outrage forced the Israeli regime to submit to the Palestinian demands partially. Palestinians have the right to defend themselves and their lands, and the resistance will go on until a complete lifting of the siege.
Palestinians here stress that the popular resistance should be held along with the armed resistance until all Palestinian demands are completely achieved. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
In a small lab in Tehran, a big dream is unfolding. An expert team comprised of over 30 young Iranian physicists and engineers are putting the first building blocks of what would be the first Iranian-made particle accelerator. Also called synchrotron, the device produces high-energy beams by accelerating electrons close to the speed of light in a large donut-shaped vacuum chamber. The process seems simple in words, but it's painstakingly complicated in practice.
At the center of this laboratory complex, a fourth-generation synchrotron is located, which accelerates electrons to nearly the speed of light by using radio frequency systems and powerful electromagnets, and finally produces exceptionally brilliant beams of light in a wide spectrum ranging from infrared and visible light to ultraviolet and hard X-rays.
First built in the 1940s, synchrotrons were originally made to study high-energy particle collisions, but it didn't take scientists long to notice the synchrotron's byproduct, an extremely bright light that can be used in investigating the structure of crystals and proteins, monitoring air pollution, studying disease mechanisms, HD imaging, and cancer radiation therapy, among other applications.
The X-ray produced in this machine is a million times brighter than the other conventional X-ray sources, and it has also unique properties such as high coherency and polarization, tunability, and ultra-short pulses, which enables the scientists to achieve high-quality imaging. Information obtained by scientists can be used to study the structure of viruses and proteins, design new drugs, precise radiography from human body, examine the structure of surfaces, build smaller and powerful computer chips, develop new materials for safer medical implants, and help with the cleanup of mining waste.
The Iranian synchrotron is for now in the R&D stage. The developer's team says the project needs $300 million to be accomplished. So far, only 1% of the budget is supplied. The team hopes by shedding light on the significance of the cutting-edge technology, it can attract the needed investment from the government.
With a wide range of applications, from medicine to agriculture, the homegrown synchrotron would transform technologies. Experts say, for sanctions hit Iran, building such a device is more than just an achievement, but a miracle. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
"We are all in this together" has been a slogan echoed repeatedly throughout the COVID-19 global health pandemic. But time and time again, it's been proven to be little more than intelligent brand marketing, as a global health crisis has laid bare not only the inequalities within societies, but also on the global stage. In Africa, considered the most resource-rich continent on the planet, but the poorest in terms of GDP, less than 2% of the continent's population of 1.3 billion has been fully vaccinated against COVID-19. While in comparison, in the European Union, 70% of adults have now been fully vaccinated, according to EU officials, leading to allegations of COVID apartheid in the international arena.
Some countries are now rolling out booster doses to fully vaccinated people when millions of people around the world have not even received their first dose.
Israel has provided 1 million Israelis their third dose, while only 18% of Palestinians in Gaza have received only one dose of the COVID vaccine.
Meanwhile, the UK, a former colonial power in Africa, is the latest to offer a third dose of the COVID vaccine to around 500,000 Brits. At a time when Africa is experiencing 248,000 new confirmed cases just last week, and 28 African countries are in the midst of a surge in infections driven by the new Delta variant.
And today we're going to go a step further by accepting the advice of the independent JCVI that anyone that is severely immunosuppressed should be offered a third dose.
According to research conducted by the Zoe COVID study, effectiveness in the Pfizer vaccine was at 88% after 1 month, but dropped to 74% after 6 months. And for AstraZeneca, the effectiveness of the vaccine was 77% after 1 month, but dropped to 67% after 4 to 5 months. This arguably demonstrates the need for third booster jabs. However, in low-income countries where there are fewer healthcare workers, weaker infrastructure, and poor access to COVID vaccines, that need is far greater. But their cry for help has thus far been ignored by the very powers that told us we are all in this together. Ahmed Kabbalah, London.
Despite intense negotiations, the Taliban and the National Resistance Front in Panjshir, headed by Ahmed Massoud, have not reached a peace agreement. As a result, the Taliban launched a major offensive from three directions on the valley of Panjshir on Wednesday night to capture an area that has yet to fall under the group's control.
Taliban have had some offensive to the Khawak High Pass from the Andarab Valley of Baghla. From our side, there were local forces of Andarab, different districts of Andarab, local forces of Panjshir, as well as the ANSF forces. They have defended very well. They have defeated Taliban on that front. Taliban have lost 40 of their personnel, another 35 of them were wounded. 4 armies of Taliban were destroyed, 2 rangers of Taliban were destroyed, and they did not succeed on their offensive.
In the meantime, the Taliban officials say the resistance in Panjshir cannot succeed because the valley is completely surrounded by the Taliban forces. Therefore, the Taliban want Massoud to surrender without any bloodshed, a demand strongly rejected by the resistance in Panjshir.
We want Massoud to surrender. We are all Muslims and we must not kill each other. Panjshir is surrounded by our forces and we will finally capture the valley. So this is better for Massoud to think about the consequences of resisting against us.
Capturing Panjshir Valley in northern Afghanistan has always been considered a big goal for the Taliban, even during their previous rule over 95% of Afghanistan before their collapse in 2001. Ahmad Shah Massoud resisted against major Taliban offensives on Panjshir and did not allow them to enter the valley even once. Now, it remains to be seen if Ahmad Massoud, the son of the legendary Afghan commander, can follow the footsteps of his father, who is also titled as the Afghan national hero in Afghanistan's constitution. Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Pakistan has stepped up security along the Afghan border. The move is part of several measures Pakistan has taken to prevent militants slipping into this side of the border. But these moves appear to have made little impact, as the number of terrorist attacks has been on the rise in recent weeks. A report by an Islamabad-based think tank reveals that in August, 45 militant attacks took place in Pakistan, the highest in a month since June 2016.
Interestingly, the sudden surge in militant attacks in Pakistan, almost twice as compared with July, was witnessed in a month in which Taliban took over Afghanistan, especially Kabul. So there is a coincidence. It is yet to be verified that is there a direct link or not, but it is a strange coincidence.
According to the report, the number of militant attacks continued to go up since May, when the US-led foreign forces started withdrawing from Afghanistan. Most of those attacks were carried out by Pakistani Taliban or Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan. Some experts link the rise in militant attacks with Afghan Taliban releasing a number of anti-Pakistan terrorists from jail.
This is because of the security vacuum which has been created, number one, in Afghanistan, and number two, the districts which have been captured by Afghan Taliban, on those districts, TTP prisoners have been released. Along with them, a number of other terrorists have been released. So this fresh wave of terrorism in Pakistan is linked with the Tehreek-e-Taliban Pakistan, which is a banned organization.
The TTP was driven out of Pakistan's erstwhile tribal areas after the country conducted a military campaign in 2015. However, Pakistan says the group still operates out of Afghanistan. Pakistan hopes the incoming government in Afghanistan will take decisive action against the TTP. But observers are skeptical if Afghan Taliban will do that, given these militant groups often share the same ideology. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
The International Atomic Energy Agency has reported that North Korea has likely restarted its Yongbyon nuclear power plant, the source of fissile material for its nuclear weapons. The news adds pressure to the U.S. to enter talks with Pyongyang, with the White House facing questions. Well, we have left the door open and obviously reached out through our channels. I don't have an update for you in terms of any response to our offer. Our offer remains to meet anywhere, anytime, without preconditions. North Korea has not accepted U.S. President Biden's administration's offer of talks because Pyongyang would like to see an end to what it views as a hostile U.S. policy toward it. In particular, Pyongyang bristles at the U.S.-led United Nations Security Council sanctions, which restrain North Korea's international trade, and the periodic military exercises involving some 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. Experts at this week's Korea Global Forum for Peace argue Washington needs to do more.
The North maintains that the Biden administration has not proposed a specific or concrete incentive. The U.S. is simply calling on the North to return to the dialogue table, but for North Korea, they need to have some tangible outcome from the talks.
The previous summits between North Korean leader Kim Jong-un and former U.S. President Donald Trump gained headlines but changed little.
With the dispatch of his North Korean nuclear envoy to the U.S. this week, South Korean President Moon Jae-in clearly recognizes time's not on his side, with a presidential election here slated to replace him next March. For U.S. President Joe Biden, however, the North Korean nuclear issue competes on a crowded agenda, with Washington's recent withdrawal from Afghanistan and a surge in COVID-19 cases in the U.S.
Still, the South Korean president seems determined to bring the U.S. and North Korea closer to the negotiating table. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Palestinians held a demonstration protesting the Israeli illegal policies against Palestinian detainees inside Israeli jails. The protest aimed at expressing solidarity with Palestinian detainees under hunger strike and demanding the release of Anhar Dik, a Palestinian woman who is expected to give birth in an Israeli jail.
Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails face bad treatment as most of them are detained with no clear charge or trial. Most of the detainees suffer from serious diseases and live in bad health conditions amid the medical negligence of the Israeli army. Anhar's is in critical condition as she is expected to give birth in a few days. The international community should be held accountable for the fate of Anhar and her baby.
Anhar is also suffering from pregnancy bipolar depression and afraid for her baby's fate in Israeli prison. The family of the pregnant Palestinian woman jailed by Israel appealed for the international community to set her free to give birth outside prison.
We held this rally to highlight the issue of our Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially Anhar al-Daik, who is going to give birth inside Israeli jails. We call on human rights groups to stand up behind Anhar. Palestinian prisoners are suffering from inhuman Israeli policies. There must be a serious action by the world community.
Eight former Palestinian prisoners gave birth to their children inside the Israeli prisons. Statistics say that out of 39 Palestinian women imprisoned in Israeli jails, 12 are mothers.
This rally aims to send a clear message of solidarity to the Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially Anhar al-Daik, who is pregnant and deprived of any medical care. We put the blame on the international community that remains silent in front of these violations against Palestinian detainees.
There are almost 5,000 Palestinian detainees in Israeli jails, including women and children, as well as administrative detainees. Palestinians here demand an end to the Israeli policies and detention against Palestinians, especially pregnant women. Ruba Shabit, Gaza.
Utter panic has once again gripped Rohingya refugee camps across India amid ongoing COVID crisis. The community is facing yet another campaign for possible deportation, with the government calling them a threat to national security and accusing them of being involved in illegal activities.
From social networks to politicians to TV debates, we are being portrayed as villains, sometimes illegal immigrants. The only reason is our faith, otherwise there are thousands of refugees here. Why are we being treated indifferently? We just want to stay alive rather than being killed in Myanmar.
Based on official estimates, more than 40,000 Rohingya refugees have fled to India after a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India, but over the last few years, hate campaigns against them has been haunting the community. The UN refugee agency responsible to support these refugees in India is of no help, they say. Activists say the most urgent need for these refugees is food, water, healthcare services, and other basic essentials, rather than a deliberate attempt to target them.
It has been 9 years we are here just to save our lives. We want to go home, but do you think situation there is appropriate for us? We have time and again cooperated with the Indian government in every possible way. We urge India to treat us on humanitarian ground, not on faith. Our case is in the Supreme Court, which is our only hope.
Most of the refugees work as daily wages to make a living, but the recent government restrictions and COVID lockdown have left many out of work. Now the community is struggling on its own to survive. Minority Rohingya Muslims have for decades fled to neighboring Bangladesh and other countries, including India. However, since the emergence of Hindu nationalist government in India, the destitute community has become victims of an expulsion campaign. Over the last few years, the community is in utter distress. Sometimes detentions in a midnight raids. Sometimes their camps being burnt mysteriously. All they want is a peaceful survival in the world's largest democracy, till the situation gets conducive in their country. Regardless of the refugee crisis around the world, the community continues to be neglected, but they say they haven't lost hope on Indian democracy despite all hardships. Munawar Zaman in the outskirts of New Delhi.
Meet Alborz, Iran's latest long-range radar that can detect any hostile aerial object in any given altitude. The Iranian domestically developed radar can track 300 targets at the same time, within a range of 450 kilometers. The high-tech equipment was unveiled on the occasion of the National Air Defense Day.
Alborz radar system is produced by our experts in Iran. It is capable of tracking any air target in high, medium, and low altitudes. Nothing can escape from this powerful radar, and even radar-evading aircrafts would be caught in the net of this advanced new radar.
Alborz radar was unveiled along with over 80 other indigenously built military hardware. Iran says the new equipment will significantly boost Iran's capability in electronic defense. And this, they say, was achieved despite all-out sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Iran's defense sector.
Despite all the restrictions and sanctions imposed on our country over the past four decades, we have managed to turn the threats into opportunities and build up our own arms arsenal. And the wide range of military hardware that you witnessed today are a result of the pressures imposed on us by our enemies.
The National Air Defense Day marks the formation of the Islamic Republic of Iran's air defense as a separate force in 2008, when it split from the country's air force. The military force says it possesses all the essential arms needed to defend Iran's skies, and 100% of the equipment, they say, are made indigenously.
Iran's air defense says the country's skies are safer than ever with its homegrown military equipment. Officials here say they owe this to four decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes that have prompted Iran to stand on its own feet and become self-sufficient in the defense industry. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The German foreign minister is the first top diplomat from a European country to visit Islamabad after Kabul fell to the Taliban. Heiko Maas arrived in the Pakistani capital hours after the U.S. forces ended their 20-year war in Afghanistan. The situation in the war-torn country was the main talking point during talks between the German and Pakistani foreign ministers. Pakistan, that shares a 2,600-kilometer-long border with Afghanistan, is concerned about the further instability in its neighboring country. The Pakistani foreign minister has this message for the world to avert yet another crisis in Afghanistan.
This is a pivotal moment in Afghanistan's history. The international community must remain engaged. Humanitarian assistance must flow. Do not let the economic collapse in Afghanistan take place.
But the German foreign minister linked the future cooperation with the Taliban living up to the promises they have made with the international community.
It is important for us that all Afghans, even those who do not support the Taliban, feel represented by this government, and it remains to be seen whether the Taliban take this into account.
Germany was part of the US-led alliance in Afghanistan, and hence the German foreign minister was asked what lessons the West should learn from their defeat in Afghanistan.
During the press conference, the German foreign minister conceded that the experiment to impose a specific form of government through military intervention was unsuccessful in Afghanistan. For him, the lesson for the West is that military intervention is not suited if it is meant for exporting and imposing a certain system on the foreign soil.
As the U.S. finally ended its military campaign in Afghanistan, there are questions now about the future of Afghanistan. The Taliban may be celebrating the victory over the U.S., but their real test has only begun. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
On the last day of August, when President Biden called the airlift of refugees from Kabul an extraordinary success, senior diplomats and military officers in Doha, Qatar, emailed out a daily situation report marked sensitive but unclassified. President Joe Biden has insisted that the evacuation of Kabul was done as efficiently as possible, but key documents obtained by the New York Times suggest otherwise. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Michael Shear, Lara Jakes, and Eileen Sullivan. The piece is titled Inside the Afghan Evacuation, Rogue Flights, Crowded Tents, Hope, and Chaos. Last day of August, when President Biden called the airlift of refugees from Kabul an extraordinary success, senior diplomats and military officers in Doha, Qatar, emailed out a daily situation report marked sensitive but unclassified. The conditions in Doha, Qatar, according to their description, were getting worse. Almost 15,000 Afghan refugees were packed into airplane hangars and wedding-style tents at Al Udeid Air Base in Doha, home to the 379th Air Expeditionary Wing and nearby Camp Al-Sayliya, a U.S. Army base in the Persian Gulf nation. 229 unaccompanied Afghan children were being held near the base, including many teenage boys who repeatedly bullied younger children. There were a large number of pregnant Afghan women, some of whom needed medical attention, and increasing reports of gastrointestinal issues among the refugees. Tensions in the temporary shelters had flared, the report said, due to prolonged stays and unpredictable exit dates. At the army base, single males, including former Afghan military personnel, were become unruly, and contraband weapons have been confiscated. Overwhelmed, neither base was testing Afghan evacuees for the coronavirus. The reports were daily distillations of the complexity, chaos, and humanity behind the largest air evacuation in U.S. history, as scores of diplomats, troops, health workers, security officials, and others scattered across the globe sought to rescue tens of thousands of refugees. Whatever plans the Biden administration had for an orderly evacuation from Afghanistan unraveled when Kabul fell in a matter of days, setting off a frenzied last-minute global mobilization. Afghan refugees pushed their way onto airplanes. Hundreds of children were separated from their parents. Rogue flights landed without manifests. Security vetting of refugees was done in hours or days rather than months or years. President Joe Biden and his aides have insisted that the evacuation of Kabul after the Taliban seized the city on 15th of August, was done as efficiently as possible. But U.S. State Department emails and documents from the Health and Human Services, from Homeland Security, and U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, as well as interviews with officials and refugee advocates, suggest otherwise. The conditions at Doha were chronicled each morning after Kabul fell in a daily situation report emailed broadly by State Department and military officials on behalf of Brigadier General Gerald Donahue, the commander of the airbase, Greta Holtz, a veteran ambassador who oversaw evacuation efforts in Kabul, and John Desrocha, the top diplomat in Qatar. Within hours of President Biden's speech on 31st of August at the White House, marking the end of America's two decades of war in Afghanistan, a private charter plane from Mazar-e-Sharif, Afghanistan's fourth largest city, arrived at the Al Udeid Air Base in Doha, one of 10 way stations in 8 countries, with no notice, carrying no American citizens, but hundreds of Afghans. The manifest for the plane, apparently chartered by an ex-Marines law firm, offered no clarity about whether its passengers deserved special visas for helping American troops in Afghanistan. There are multiple other rogue flights that are seeking the same permissions to land, emails from the U.S. State Department officials sent that day said. We have 300 people in Doha now who are basically stateless. Most of them have no papers whatsoever. 2 days later, officials in Doha reported even more grim news. A 19-month-old baby girl who arrived from Kabul with pre-existing conditions died at the airbase amid ongoing concerns about dehydration, coronavirus, and cholera among the Afghan refugees. The child's father is with her at the hospital, officials wrote in an email with the subject line, Operation Allies Refuge SITREP No. 19. Department of Defense and State Department are working to ensure the child's remains will be processed and able to be returned to the family. Administration officials have acknowledged the rough conditions at Doha, but say they are working to improve them. White House officials have declined to comment for this article. The total number of evacuees and where they are currently waiting is still not clear, though President Biden said on Tuesday, 31st of August, that more than 120,000 had been evacuated. As of Friday, 3rd of September, Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, said about 40,000 people had arrived in the United States at airports near Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia. Officials expect about 17,000 more to arrive by next Friday, and thousands more may ultimately end up living in a dozen other countries. American officials have said the refugees are being thoroughly vetted, with the authorities feeding fingerprints, portraits, and biographical information into federal databases to weed out potential risks. Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security, said the Defense Department had sent hundreds of biometric screening machines to 30 countries, but unclassified briefing documents titled 2021 Afghanistan Repatriation Mission reveal that in some cases, spotty information is being collected. Flight manifests have been at times incomplete or even missing. Visa or citizenship status is unknown, and there is a lack of basic demographic data. The documents show that the flights into the United States started as a trickle. On 19th of August, 4 days after the Taliban took over Kabul, 226 people on two separate flights arrived at Dulles International Airport. Jordan Air JAV 4825 included 44 dogs, but no information about its 58 passengers. Just 10 days later, on 29th of August, 13 flights landed at Dulles International Airport, carrying 3,842 people, including 6 refugees who tested positive for the coronavirus and 6 unaccompanied Afghan boys, 4 teenagers, 1 younger school-age boy, and 1 Afghan toddler. Flight CMB-581, which landed that day at 6:38 p.m., carried 240 passengers. But government records provide few details. About 3 American citizens, including 2 people over the age of 65 and 1 passenger who tested positive for the coronavirus. The rest of the details are listed as unknown. Alejandro Mayorkas said, of the about 40,000 people who had reached the United States from Afghanistan, about 22% were United States citizens and legal permanent residents, and the rest were Afghan citizens, including many who were at risk of retribution at the hands of the Taliban. confusion about the Afghan refugees began before they left Kabul, as overwhelmed consular officials struggled to identify and verify those who had valid claims to be evacuated. A senior State Department official who was in Kabul described a desperate situation at the gates of the airport, around the city's airport, and crowds that were so frenzied that officials worried they could slip into a mob at any given moment. The Taliban changes criteria at checkpoints on a day-to-day basis, hour-by-hour basis even, the official said. At first, diplomats sent an electronic badge or code to Afghans who had been cleared for evacuation to show to security guards at the gates of the airport. But it was shared so widely that officials no longer knew who should be let in. Within an hour, everyone in the crowd had that new pass on their phones, the official said. Every day was a constant improvisational effort to figure out what was going to work that day, he said. As I would say, everybody who lived it is haunted by the choices we had to make. Another official, a 25-year-old veteran of the U.S. State Department, arrived in Kabul on 17th of August, just 2 days after the Taliban took over the city, and was immediately told to work the gates. She described being sandwiched between security forces at all times while Afghan security forces swung sticks studded with nails at the crowd. Afghan security guards frequently deployed flashbang grenades and tear gas to try to disperse the crush of people. Both State Department officials described the events in Kabul in separate briefings to journalists, but were not allowed to be identified under ground rules set by press officers. As many as 30 unaccompanied Afghan children showed up at her gate each day and were taken to a secure compound as officials sought to find their parents before they were flown to Qatar, often alone. You couldn't leave them just there, she said, recalling one Afghan boy around the age of 13 who had blood all over his clothes. Someone in the crowd had been killed right in front of him, he told the American official. It was horrible what people had to go through to get in, she said.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of The Lantern. I hope everyone's doing well wherever you are. This show finds you in the best state of health, wealth, and spirituality. And you're keeping safe and socially distant throughout these difficult times, which we will, inshallah ta'ala, overcome with the grace of Allah and the prayers of our Master and Imam. May Allah hasten his reappearance. Anyone who knows me knows that I have a habit, or rather, I have a knack for having absolutely outlandish, over-the-top, weird dreams. Just a while ago, I dreamt that I was a Russian boxer, and which is weird because I don't even watch boxing movies. But the point is, our subconscious really goes on a ride when we're dreaming, and our creativity and our imagination manifests itself to the fullest in that realm. Why am I talking about dreams? Because the short anecdote we're going to hear is about having weird dreams, but that's not the point of today's discussion. Let's hear it real quick. We'll talk about what the moral of the story is.
In the name of Allah, the Almighty, dear friends, salamu alaikum. You are listening to the program Lantern from IRIB English Radio. As usual, we have an interesting story at the first step of this episode. Living this dream is the title of today's story. I woke up today having dreamt morning at 4 a.m. I was in a mall in Ethiopia, looking to buy a pair of socks and necktie. As I walked in, I noticed a sweater with a price tag of 9,000 birr. Next to the sweater were a pair of jeans for 10,000 birr. I went looking for a salesperson. He was showing a man a 225 birr Rolex watch. Shocked, I asked the salesperson, "How could a Rolex watch sell for 225 birr and a cheap pair of socks sell for 8,000 birr?" He said someone stole it into the store at night and changed the price tag on everything. Everyone is confused. People are acting like they have lost their sense of value. They are willing to pay lots of money for things of little value and very little money for things of great value. It's like they don't know what is really valuable and what's not. I hope we get the price tags back on right soon. I really pity people paying way too much for things of little value. I woke up confused and thinking since then, maybe our life is like this dream. Maybe someone slid into our lives and changed the price on everything. Maybe they mark up the value of competition, position, titles, fame, promotion, show-off, money, and power. Maybe we are all living this dream. Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
So the moral of the story is basically how sometimes in life the value of things shift, and especially in today's society we often see that things that were considered as values perhaps 20, 30, 100 years ago before the world wars or before industrial revolution are now not only are they now no longer important, but they've turned into somehow anti-values. And it's so strange. The other day I was reading this post that was, you know, basically centered on empowering women and having gender equality and human rights and this and that. And one of the agendas that they were pushing was to stop using the term modesty regarding women, and how expecting a woman to be modest and applying that word to her constantly and as if defining it as one of her duties degrades her and discourages her from doing more, and is the opposite of empowering a woman, and it restricts her potential and the possibilities, the achievements she could have. I don't know what sort of turn we took in life as a species where eliminating terminating the life of a fetus or actively avoiding the use of the word modesty regarding women, allowing same-sex marriage, defining a family as a person with their dog or with their cat, and advocating these sort of things became a value. But obviously, I mean, if we look at almost all holy scriptures and resources, we can see that they all state such a phenomenon toward the end of times. And it seems that the more humanity progresses through time, the longer humanity occupies this planet, the lesser adherent it becomes to certain values, and the value and worth of things drastically shift. I'm not saying that it's always a bad thing. This progress has definitely led to things that were values back then being redefined. Maybe 40, 50 years ago, having white colored skin was considered as a value, which in reality, even Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala states in the Quran that your worth and your value is based on your conduct and the level of taqwa and piety that you have, in how much you prioritize Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and His satisfaction and the things you do, the decisions you make, the paths you take on in life. Something that the Quran mentions under the topic of value is, and it's a recurring theme, honestly, which Allah constantly reminds us of throughout the verses of the Quran, is that this world, the value of this world is worth absolutely nothing, or at least very, very little compared to the hereafter. And I feel that often, at least for myself, that is another arena where I'm constantly shifting my own values. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you so very much for sharing with us your valuable time. Until another segment, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanallah.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.